Hello, everyone, and welcome to the newest episode of Hanging with Toby Hooper. I am one of your Hanging with Toby Hooper co-hosts, Patrick Bromley, joined, as always, by my Hanging with Toby Hooper co-host, Heather Wixon. Hi, Heather.
Hello. I was getting ready to have like a quote all set for this episode to open with,
Okay.
and I failed. So I am the opposite of fun for the fun house.
Oh, we're talking about the fun house. This is very exciting. This, as we've already spoiled, is my very favorite movie from my very favorite director. So this is going to be a big old love fest from me.
It's like an early birthday present for you.
It is. I'm very excited to talk about this. Before we talk about the funhouse, you know what we should do?
What should we do, Patrick?
We should talk about the book we wrote.
We wrote a book, and you got to write about the funhouse for the book.
I did. We've been going on other people's podcasts promoting this book, and I'm like, well, we should probably promote it on our podcast too.
Right.
It's called In Search of Darkness. And it is the companion piece to the three-part documentary series that you can stream on Shudder about 80s horror. And we wrote a big, a whopping five-pounder.
We did. We've birthed a five-pounder with this book. One thing I want to mention to people, though, just so like to temper expectations.
Ah, yes. Good.
Is that you have to read what I wrote. No, I'm just joking. Is that the book only covers In Search of Darkness 1 and 2 because this actually started for us before 3 was like underway.
Right.
So I don't want people to get the book and be like, well, where's this from part 3 and this and that? And I'm like, and there's a lot of great films in part 3 that I wish we would have gotten to write about. So I'm a little bummed in that capacity, but also like I needed my sanity back after writing this book. So I'm okay with it. But yeah, so this definitely is a comprehensive look at the 142, I believe, movies that were featured in Search of Darkness 1 and 2.
Yes. If you are disappointed that part 3 is not in the book, contact the publisher, tell them you want another installment of this book, and that you want me and Heather to write it.
Yes. Well, I guess I can kind of spoil this. There is going to be a paperback edition,
right,
of this book released later this year. And I have posited to our publisher about potentially putting in some extra stuff in there.
Okay.
To kind of make it worthwhile for folks,
right,
which might be a few movies from part 3, perhaps some of a few more tributes.
Oh, good.
Just because, yes, well, also just because like we just kind of ran out of time, like trying to get everything done, because
right,
it's not just the movies, like there's a lot of other content in this book,
yeah,
which was a huge undertaking. So, but it's something we're going to discuss in April, because right now in March, we're just trying to get through this month, get everybody their books, and maybe try to enjoy the moment just a little bit.
Yes. If you live in the Los Angeles area, actually, on April 27th at 2 p.m. at Dark Delicacies in Burbank, California, we're going to be signing copies of this book alongside giants of horror like Joe Dante and Kelly Maroney and Tom Holland and Steve Johnson and two of the Kyoto brothers.
We might have a third, still waiting to hear back.
That's a full Kyoto Voltron if you get all three.
I know, right? Which is very exciting always to get the full Kyoto Voltron. Which is funny because I'm actually, they're in Monsters Makeup and Effects Volume 3.
Of course.
And they worked on so many different like projects, like they were kid related, like throughout the 80s and 90s and stuff. No Voltron, but they did work on Power Rangers.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah. So, yeah, we actually might be also having some surprise guests as well. And we do have a few other folks who are on board tentatively, but I have to check back in with them in early April. But it is going to basically be like this huge sort of big killer 80s horror party. and I'm really excited. Like I'm stoked to get to go and sign, but like let's be honest, like go get your book signed by Joe Dante
Yeah,
and
right.
all these other folks, like, 'cause they're the reason we're there. So
Yeah, I'm like freaked out to be sitting at a table with some of these people.
like if we get the other certain guests that we were talking about, I'm gonna sit you between them and Kelly Maroney and just make you really nervous.
What are you even doing to me?
And then Erica can watch on the whole entire time as your face is like totally beet red. Yeah, no, it's gonna be fun. Actually, and I'm waiting to find out if Derek's gonna be coming out too. Just because he was a big part of getting this thing across the finish line as well. So
Yeah.
I'm all about trying to like when people work hard, I celebrate it. Which seems to be sort of the antithesis sometimes of the entertainment journalism writing world. But I'm all about giving people their due. And so I was like, you should be here too, because this there's no way we would be doing this
Right.
and getting to celebrate this, without him fact checking and correcting quotes and
Right.
just going in and pulling everything apart and putting it back together. So for that, I'm forever indebted to Derek for his due diligence, because he did a lot of diligence.
Yes, he did. If you're interested in ordering the book, you can go to aminkpublishing.com slash in dash search dash of dash darkness. And you can order a copy there. If you want to order a signed copy, you can go to the Dark Delicacies website, and they're actually selling copies of the book that you can get signed even if you can't be there, and then they will ship those to you. They cost about $15 more, but my God, is it worth it when you consider how much you would pay for Heather's signature at a con?
Well, here's the thing. Who the frick would invite me to a convention? Like,
It's
come
gonna
on now.
happen.
I'm no horror icon,
You
Patrick.
are, we've, listen, we've had this discussion. We decided
Like
that
some
yes, you are.
folks. No, I'm anything but. I'm a horror geek who got very, very lucky, and got to write a book with her horror BFF.
Woohoo!
And it's pretty amazing, honestly. Like, I can't believe we did this.
I know. I'm
It's still
excited.
not real. I don't even know if even when it arrives, I still don't know if it's going to feel real.
No, it won't. I was talking
Yeah.
about this just yesterday. Like, no matter what, it feels like something that someone else did.
Yeah, I'm just like, oh, okay, I'm going to get this really fun book, and I'm like, who did this book? It's like, did I do this book? I'm like, oh,
And
I
you've
guess
been
I
through
did.
this before. You've written books. You've done signings.
I guess so. This is gonna be my fourth book.
Yeah, that's
What?
amazing, right? Look at you.
That is so stupid. By the way, this is how much I maybe it just doesn't really resonate with me because like of how it like is reacted to in my everyday life. But like I talked to my mom over the weekend and I was like, oh yeah, like the book is coming out. We put together this really big signing. And I'm getting ready to be like telling her about this signing, and she's just like, "Yeah, so work's been kind of like weird lately." And I'm just like, "Okay." So I don't know. Maybe it's like that's my disassociation with it a little bit. But I'm really excited. Like it does feel not real
Yeah.
still.
Yeah.
And maybe it's really not even going to hit me till we do the signing.
Well, it'll be fun no matter what.
It is. It's good. Yeah. I mean, honestly, if it was you and me doing it, I would still be stoked AF, as the kids say, to be there. And especially too, because it is a big financial thing for Dark Delicacies to take it on, because it's not a cheapy book. So I really appreciate the support from Dell and Sue, for wanting to do this and giving us like a little chance to, come out and celebrate it. And I'm just so glad that you and Erica are going to get to come out.
Yeah, it's very, very cool. It's kind of a once in a lifetime experience for me. Like I said, I know you've done this before, but for me, this is kind of a once in a lifetime thing. So,
I think this just means we have to write another book.
sure.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a few other things to take care of, but
Yes, you do.
I mean, who needs free time? Obviously, not me, not this gal.
So if you are listening to this and you can come out or even just order a book online, please do, because as Heather just said, Dell and Sue kind of took a chance on us having this signing, and we would love for it to be a huge success and have them sell out of books. So everybody buy a book.
Yes. Like, don't do it for us. Do it for Dell and for Sue,
Yes.
because they're like the patron saints of horror print
Yeah.
and giving people a chance. Like, I'm so grateful for everything that they've done for me over the years, and getting to return to Dark Delicacies is always a blast. And then I just have to like do my signing and get out of there without spending like $1,000 because I want to buy everything.
And do it for yourself, because you'll have a book signed by Joe Dante and Steve Johnson and Tom Holland and Heather.
And Patrick
Oh yeah.
and others.
And
It's a
others
different.
as well. But as Heather mentioned, one of the movies that we write about in this book is a little movie called The Fun House from 1981. And
It is.
here's the plot synopsis from IMDb. Two young couples on a double date go to a mysterious carnival. As a prank, they decide to spend the night in the funhouse. When they witness a brutal murder, they suddenly find themselves in horrific danger. That's by Sean V. Taylor on IMDb, and I read it because it's the shortest summary.
Nice.
The others are considerably longer. And I
I
didn't
did
want to
see
go through
one
the
where it
whole
was like,
plot.
yeah, I was like, that would be like 20 minutes.
Yeah. Which, I mean, could eat up a lot of time on this episode, and maybe that's good, because it's less heavy lifting that we have to do.
Exactly.
You grew up, correct me if I'm wrong, seeing clips of this. Are there clips of this in the theatrical? It's been a long time since I saw it, and we were just talking about this on another podcast. Are there clips of the Funhouse in the theatrical Terror in the Isles, or is it only on the TV version?
It is only on the TV version. And because I grew up with the theatrical version of Terror in the Isles, The Funhouse is actually a movie that I missed for quite a long time. I do kind of remember seeing it, I want to say like in high school, but it
Okay.
just didn't like click with me. So really, it was like the Scream Factory Blu-ray
Okay.
where I was like, I'm like, this is one of Patrick's very favorite movies. I'm like, it's Tobe Hooper. Like, I bought it like immediately, because I was like, gotta support it. And it's funny because like it's an, I like the Funhouse a lot. I will say, one, after reading what your writings on it for the In Search of Darkness book, and then also knowing that I was prepping for like this episode.
Yeah.
So I rewatched it a couple times over the last few days, and I really like it so much more even now.
Yeah, that was sort of my experience with it. It was not on my radar growing up. I finally saw it in the late 90s. I bought a book that I like, but our book that we wrote is better. It's called Psychos, Sickos, Sequels, and it's by John Stell, and it's all about 80s horror. But it's a lot of just like plot synopsis and like this actor made this movie. But he writes about the Funhouse, and I was like, I've never even heard of this. And they have pictures of Elizabeth Berridge in the shower with the guy with the knife, pulled up hanging over her. And I'm like, what is this movie? And it says it's by Tobe Hooper, and I know who Tobe Hooper is. So I blind bought a DVD and watched it, and like I thought it was okay. I was like, yeah, that's about as good as this author had promised it would be, which is like it's a decent little 80s programmer. And then a couple years went by, and I went to a 24-hour marathon at the Music Box with some friends, and they all left around 2 a.m. after Pet Sematary, I think. And at 3 a.m., a brand new print of the Funhouse begins to unspool. And between my sleep deprivation, the colors on the print, the sound design, seeing it on a big screen, there were all these factors. And it was like watching a new movie, and I completely fell in love with it. And it was actually like that screening that really sent me down like a Tobe Hooper rabbit hole where I started just consuming all of his movies either again or for the first time and realized like, oh, I click with this guy better than any other director. This is my favorite filmmaker. So really I have the Funhouse to thank for my love of Tobe Hooper. And I've seen it countless times since. I just screened it last October as part of the Smash Cut series that I do. And it was great to see it on a big screen again because you really do. I was seeing it with Erica, and she'd seen it before too, but it was fun to watch her react to it like she was seeing it for the first time because seeing it on a big screen was like a new experience for her. And I just adore this movie.
Yeah, I the thing that really sets it apart for me in terms of like some of the other movies that were in 81, like, you know, obviously it's a standalone movie, you know, we're not quite
Right.
a sequel.
Right.
But it's like it's just really freaking creepy, even when it's not trying to be creepy. Which is like it that's not an easy thing to achieve. And it makes you realize, like, as a kid, like we grew up in the day and age where like carnivals were coming through all the time and things like that, and like we just would like get on these rides and do these things and like just assume that the people working there were all like upstanding citizens who gave a crap about like our safety and well-being. And you know, Tobe Hooper, much like hey with Texas Chainsaw, where he's like, oh, you're gonna take a road trip, oops, and you're gonna go to your, you know, family estate and ponder, you know, wander upon this other property and oops, you're screwed. You know, he once again sort of takes something that should be fun or
Right.
just, you know, isn't necessarily a direct threat and turns it into something that's really sinister.
Yeah.
And he does it extremely well. Like it's, you know, I mean, it's got rough edges to it,
Yeah.
but I actually think that's the charm of it because a movie about this environment, this world, and these characters should not be polished. Like it shouldn't be. I wouldn't expect the Funhouse to come out the same way as something like Poltergeist, because it is kind of a little more of a roughshod concept. So therefore, I like the fact that it is a little rough around its edges because I think it actually makes the film even more effective, kind of the way Texas Chainsaw does.
Yeah, for sure. I think Tobe Hooper is almost incapable of making a movie that's all smooth edges. I think outside of Poltergeist, this is probably his slickest movie, just in terms of the Laszlo Kovacs photography and the use of the widescreen frame and the Steadicam stuff that he does. Like, this feels slicker than a lot of his movies, and when I watch it, it's the one I can most easily draw the one-to-one between this and Poltergeist. I'm like, yeah, you can tell the same guy made these two movies. It's so funny because I don't know if you listened to the commentary track at all. Tobe Hooper commentary tracks are a little frustrating because he's not very forthcoming. He's not real chatty. And so it's him and Tim Sullivan, and Tim Sullivan is just talking a mile a minute, trying to get stuff out of Tobe Hooper. And Toby's just like, yeah, it was a good shoot. And he wanted to make the movie because he was such a fan of Nightmare Alley as a kid, which takes place largely at a carnival. And he was like, I want to do a movie at a carnival too. And so that's why he takes the script for the Funhouse, which, if you read a little bit about the original script for the Funhouse, it was a lot sleazier and more mean-spirited, the original Larry Block script, which is hard to believe because this is a pretty sleazy movie. But it was a lot, it was almost like Humanoids from the Deep level sleazy originally, where the Gunther monster was like
Oh
literally
boy.
ripping the clothes off of and raping every female character in the movie, including some who don't appear in the finished film. And I'm so glad that they pulled back on all that. You know, there's still some gross shit that goes on, but like, It never becomes offensive, and I think that version of the movie would have been like offensive.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting too, because I was reading an old article from Fangoria, and apparently this was something that Toby had even been working on pre-Salem's Lot, kind of like when he was sort of in sort of a down trajectory in his career, post-Texas Chainsaw, and was really surprised then once Salem's Lot turned out who it was, and it was well received, and the theatrical overseas did as well as it did. And Universal's like, well, what about this movie? Like, we want to do a movie about teenagers, what do you got? And this movie kind of came about, which is interesting to me that, like, I don't know if Universal maybe was like, when they saw the original script, was like, this is cool, but ... maybe let's pull it, rein it in a little bit. Because to me, that would be, that I think that would result in a completely different movie. And maybe not one that I would necessarily enjoy as much. It was interesting too, because I was reading a review, I think it was from like the New York Times when they originally reviewed the movie, and they were saying that they said that Gunther rapes one of the characters at a certain point, which I think is supposed to be Liz, but I don't think he does. I mean, we don't see anything that insinuates that he's doing that to her.
Correct. If it happens at all, it happens off screen, but we are never clued in that she sort of promises to go along with him sexually. She's saying like, I can make you feel good. And then the next thing we see, he's attacking and probably killing her. So yeah, I don't think that that happens.
And what's really dumb is because this is how my brain works. It's like every time she's like, I can make you feel good. And there's like a bit on America Dead when Roger the Alien's like, I can make you feel good. And that just like, every time when I was rewatching it, I just started giggling myself because I was from
You can
America Dead.
always tie it back to American Dad.
I like, honest to God, I'm not even joking. So there's repertory screenings coming up for Rad, the bike movie. And I was like, I told Brian, I'm like, we have to go because you need to see Rad because he's seen the episode of American Dad that celebrates Rad like so many times, but he's never seen Rad. And I was like, that's legitimately like how my brain works. But that's the beauty of Seth MacFarlane. He does like the weirdest shit. Where he's like, hey, we could do these really super popular movies, or we can go obscure and give you Rad. But yeah, it's really fun to me because like again, I was somebody who grew up going to a lot of different carnivals. Even in my teen years, like I don't know, like because we always would get one in Villa Park. It was in the parking lot of the Kmart. Different though, it wasn't like oddities and stuff like that. But I do remember when I was little, like there were animals and stuff at the ones I was going to because like there's pictures of me riding like tiny ponies and stuff like that. So like there's part of me that like remembers the high school years where I'm just like, wait, were carnivals this elaborate? And then I was like, oh yeah, they really were back in the 80s. Where like they actually traveled with animals and stuff like that. And I think it's really interesting too that like to do this movie, like they got a real carnival to come out to Florida, and basically set up camp to make this movie, which I also think is really funny because it's on the sound stage of Flipper, of all things. Because when I think of Flipper, I think of murderous carnival people, paying people for sex, and they go hand in hand.
I gave Flipper $20 for a handy one time.
Worth every penny, I bet.
It took me more than one viewing, and I should be ashamed to say this. I don't think I caught on the first viewing, like the foreshadowing of the baby in the jar or the cow, during the sequence where they just dick around the carnival for like a long time, which I want to come back to in a second. That both of those are clearly meant to foreshadow the Gunther monster in terms of like the cleft lip and the kind of like almost two-face thing that he's got going on. The baby in the jar sort of comes into play in the novelization, which I own and have read by Dean Koontz under a pseudonym.
Where did you get that novelization, Patrick?
I believe my horror BFF sent it to me.
Yes, I found that one day and I was like, oh my God.
Along with my, not along with, but you also sent me the 27 by 41 sheet that I have hanging in my office for the fun house, because it's the good one. It's not the one with the stupid mouth on it that's drooling. It's the worst movie poster ever. This is the amazing one with the little Jack in the Box. So the novelization spends, I don't know, two thirds of its time talking about like the parents of all the characters, like
Oh, interesting.
Gunther's mom and dad. And she has like a gypsy curse put on her. And then it turns out that she gets remarried later in life and she's Amy's mom, if I'm remembering this correctly. So her, Amy and Gunther are technically like half siblings, but so much of it is not the movie. It's all this stuff that happens before the movie, including possibly maybe a sibling, a different sibling or something for Gunther that I remember when I saw the baby in the jar. On a subsequent viewing, I was like, oh, that feels like that comes out of the, or that that's that. Not that it comes from the novelization, but the novelization draws from that because the novelization obviously happened after the movie.
Yeah, although it was technically apparently released before the movie because the movie
Yeah.
was delayed. So that was
Right.
always like the confusion that everybody's like, oh, it's based on this
It's
book. And
based on a
everyone's like,
book, right? Exactly.
and it's like, no, that's not how it worked out. It's interesting too, like, because you mentioned like sort of the cow stuff, that apparently, like, on set, Gunther was actually just called Cowman.
Sure.
That was how they like referenced him
Better
like
name
on
for him
production.
and better name for the movie.
I like Gunther though. I don't know. There's something intriguing about that.
Toby Hooper's Cowman.
Cowman. Like, could you imagine like going to see a movie called Cowman?
One for Cowman, please.
Yes, one, you know, two for Cowman because you got to bring four. Yeah, but I thought that was kind of interesting that like, oh my God, my brain just totally stopped where I was going with that thought. But yeah, it was when I. That was really intriguing about the in terms of like the character of Gunther and sort of what he represents. And look, if somebody gets upset because you have like a character with a sort of a deformity being turned into a monster, yet again, sort of a la Leatherface and Texas Chainsaw, like I think it's completely a valid, you know, discussion to be having because I, you know, I get it. And it was interesting too because it was something that Rick Baker actually felt really shitty about. When he came on board, he didn't want to portray somebody who had some sort of physical abnormality as a monster. So that's actually why like a lot of Gunther is like exaggerated because it needed to be.
Yeah,
Because for him,
he's
yeah, he didn't want to just turn it into, oh, you've got a cleft palate, you're obviously this monster. Like that wasn't his, you know, that was something he was like, no, we don't want to do that.
No,
So
he made him a literal monster. Like it goes way beyond just he has a deformity. I have never watched this movie and been like, "Hey, they're turning this deformed guy into the villain just because he's deformed." Like, no, Gunther is a literal monster.
which also maybe is why they kind of called him Cowman, because maybe it
Maybe.
would like help them sort of dehumanize him a little bit
Right.
even more so during production.
Right.
You know, but yeah, and I was, and I think even Rick like got busy, so he wasn't able to like be on set and stuff. So it was like Craig Reardon who went on to have like this really amazing career, post Funhouse, who was a guy who was kind of working on set every day.
Wouldn't this have
But
been around the time of American Werewolf? They
he
both
might have
came
had to
out in
go.
81. I don't know when he was working on American Werewolf.
Yeah, because I think I'm like, I mean, this was sort of because it was delayed. Yeah, so he probably would have had to like leave to go do American Werewolf.
Okay.
Because I also know too that he had recommended, because I know apparently Toby's kid loved Rick Baker's work on Kong. And so that's why they had a meeting. And so that's when Rick Baker agreed to do it and then decided he couldn't do the on-set stuff.
Okay.
So he brought in Craig Reardon. By the way, this is kind of funny to me. Like, so Craig Reardon in the interview in Fangoria, like, kind of buries the movie. Where he's like, yeah, it needed a better script. And I was just like, oh, damn, like, you can't, like, who was your publicist back then, sir? And basic, but also says, like, talk shit about Alien. Where he's
Interesting
just,
choice.
I know, he's like, yeah, like that movie Alien, where it's like you get a bunch of characters and you don't really care about them. So when they start dying, you're like, whatever. And I was like, whoa, Alien? You were thinking that about Alien. Okay.
Well, I think this movie's reputation is that it's like just okay. Because for a long time, there was talk about a remake. Eli Roth was attached to a remake at one point. And the general consensus, I remember this was back when like Ryan Turek had a podcast, and I remember him talking about Eli Roth is attached to make the Funhouse, which is good. That's the kind of movie that should be remade. Because it's just okay. It's like got an intriguing setting and an okay premise, but like the execution isn't great. And I wonder how much of that has to do with like this movie has like the Death Proof structure in which we just hang out with characters for about 50% of the runtime before it even becomes a horror movie. And I
Right.
feel like maybe some audiences don't have the patience for that. I love the movie, so
No.
I'm fine with them just dicking around the carnival, and I like that we check in on William Finley, and I like that there's a peep show at the carnival. Like there's so many weird things that you don't find at carnivals now, before they even decide to go into the fun house. But I get why some people would maybe bristle at the pacing.
No, I totally get it. But also, too, like if you want that faster paced sort of similar story theme type of experience, Hellfest kind of delivers on that regard too for me. Like I legitimately love Hellfest. And it's funny too, because like we play like horror trivia and they always talk about like how Hellfest is like a carnival type thing where I'm like, no, it's like Six Flags. Like this that thing ain't moving anywhere. Like that is a stationary event. But yeah, like if you want that, Hellfest works. I like a good hangout movie. Toby does them really well, as we've seen with like Eggshells and stuff. Like, he's okay with us just hanging out with characters. And I think in this day and age, like I'm always really happy when you get movies like that. I think that's why like I really loved X, because there's a lot of that movie that does feel like a hangout movie.
Yeah, definitely.
That I think if Toby was here, he would totally love that. And I think for me, that's the kind of experience that I kind of gravitate towards myself, maybe because I'm old, whatever. But I don't mind it because I also think too, like it really establishes like the atmosphere of what these kids are in, once they get to the carnival, because it's, if it was just like them getting there and all of a sudden it's like a hack and slash, like who cares? Then Craig Reardon has a point. But I actually do care, I mean, especially about Amy, because they set her up pretty well, I think, in this movie. Where even like her parents are there picking up her brother, and she's so close to like being able to get out, but she can't get out.
And I love that the opening of the movie sets that up. Like you're watching this movie, and this is not the first, because I think I started to say that in my chapter for In Search of Darkness, and then I had to change it because there were a couple movies that were doing similar things around this time, including like Student Bodies. It's not the first to like spoof Halloween. John Carpenter's Halloween, or Psycho, or like to use the language of those movies in a way that subverts what's actually going on. But it's among the first, it's 81, and horror movies in their current iteration had only been around for a few years at this point, really since Halloween in 78, when it kind of changed the language of horror movies. So we're talking about, 4 years later, and it sets up one thing, and then, you know, this movie, one of the things that I love about the Funhouse is that Tobe Hooper keeps sort of pulling the rug out from underneath you. So you think that Amy is just this topless girl in a shower who's about to be stabbed, a la Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho. It turns out to be her little brother. It's a weird sort of perverse prank that he's playing on his sister.
Yeah,
And
by
you
the way, do you feel like they just like there's no weirdness about her him seeing her naked for as long as he does?
Oh, it's definitely weird.
Okay, cool. It's not just me then, because I'm always
No.
like, we're just you're just okay, like you're not even covering up.
Right. No,
And
she seems irritated that he scared her and is unfazed by the "you're looking at me naked."
yeah.
And you kind of think that that's the function of the scene, where it's just because, you know, a common theme throughout the Funhouse is like what you're seeing isn't all there is to it, right? Whether it's Gunther later with the Frankenstein mask on, and you're like, oh, I get it, he's a monster. And then he pulls off the mask, and it's like, oh, there's a scarier monster underneath. So there's like layers to all this stuff, and that's what's so clever about it. But you kind of think that, like, oh, it's just a misdirect. It's just this goofy opening that's being self-referential and paying tribute to these other horror movies. And it's, you know, kind of telling us what to expect. But at no point do we realize that, like, oh, that's the literal inciting incident that traps Amy in the funhouse later in the movie, because her brother could say, like, she's in there, I know where she is, but he doesn't, because he's living in fear of her reprisal. And so that's the reason she and her friends get stuck in the funhouse and three of them die.
So basically what you're saying is that Joey is the real villain of the Funhouse. It's not Gunther, it's Joey.
I've been saying it for years.
Damn kids.
Joey is, he's a monster kid, and I love that about him.
Yeah.
But he's also a little pervert and responsible for several deaths.
And like also like how checked out are those parents when they pick him up? Like they seem annoyed.
They're checked
Like
out when we first see them when they're watching Bride of Frankenstein on TV. Like, they are just checked out people, which again is like, the movie is sort of about these weird familial relationships, whether it's Amy's family or Gunther's family, and the roles that parents play in our lives, you know, and then which harkens again back to Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the weird family dynamics in that movie. They're so checked out.
So basically, Conrad Straker is like the best parent in the whole movie.
Oh yeah.
I mean, like he gets like Gunther's like a lot to deal with, but he's like gonna get him through it because it's his son, you know.
Right.
And then also when he finds Joey, like he's got genuine concern about him. Again, the weird stroking of the face is a little too much, but you know, it's maybe concern. Hopefully, not something super weird. I don't know.
We've unlocked this whole movie.
We really have.
Yeah.
But yeah, like it's definitely interesting to sort of see the different dynamics of parents. Because also too, like in 80s horror movies, like parents usually are pretty much a non-factor
Yeah.
in a lot of ways. Like they're just kind of they don't really exist
Right.
in most of them.
Or
So
they
it's
are like downright, they're the Elm Street parents, where it's like
oh yeah.
they go
We're
beyond not existing to the point where they're fucking everything up.
Yeah. So it's interesting to sort of see the trajectory of how parents are like approached throughout 80s horror.
Yeah.
Because this is a very interesting little case study where it's like, yeah, obviously Straker and his, you know, what they're doing at the carnival is very much not a great thing for obvious reasons, but he's a good dad, you know. I mean, he's
Yeah.
not like the best dad, but you know, he has genuine concern and interest in his kid, like
Right.
trying to help him out after he murders Madame Zina, like you know.
He's not happy about it. You know, you get the
Which
feeling
he
that
should be.
Gunther's going to be grounded.
Right? Yeah, you know, no TV for Gunther for like the next 2 weeks.
Yes, of course. By the way, I think earlier I attributed the cinematography to Laszlo Kovacs, and I just want to apologize because it's Andrew Laszlo.
Yes, different Laszlo. So many
Ugh,
Laszlos.
how
But you know
embarrassing.
if there's, but you know what? You know if there's a Laszlo in the name, you know it's a good cinematographer.
Your movie's gonna look good.
Yeah, because he did the Warriors, right? Did I
That
read
was
that right?
why Tobe Hooper wanted him, yeah, because he liked how
Okay,
the
gotcha.
Warriors had looked.
I figured you'd know since you wrote the book on it.
Well, I wrote a chapter of a book.
But it's on it.
It
It's your own little mini funhouse book.
is on it. You're right.
It's your Gale Weathers moment, Patrick. Take it.
Oh, sure. I'll send you a copy.
Yes, there you go. And then I can be like, you were my 90s.
Bam, bitch went down.
We're just going to quote scream movies from now on.
Yeah, Sid, super bitch. Okay, so where are we at on the Funhouse? What are your feelings on like Buzz and Richie?
Well, first of all, I've just figured out that Cooper Huckabee was 30 years old in this movie.
He sure was.
And Elizabeth Berridge, who
Yeah.
plays Amy, is like 10 years younger than him.
Yeah.
But he wins her a bear, so that's good. I mean, obviously, Richie's the reason we get everything gets all messed up because he had to go steal.
Right.
Like, don't never steal from carnies. Like, that's just
Richie's
a life lesson I've known forever.
kind of the worst.
Yeah, he is. I mean, but you kind of need somebody in a horror movie to be the worst.
Right.
Because you almost need that balance.
Yeah. I never took like I guess we're supposed to, you know, Amy and what's her face, Liz, are supposed to be in high school, I guess, and possibly even Richie. I always thought Buzz was like a guy who had graduated already. So I just always have read him as early 20s, not quite as old as 30, obviously, but I always read him as like early 20s. So his casting as a younger guy never totally bothered me. But I also like, I don't find him to be a particularly likable or sympathetic character, which again, I kind of like for the movie because Amy has this idea of how the date is going to go, and slowly she realizes that, like, Buzz kind of sucks. He does, you know, try to save her life at the end, so he does redeem himself. I don't mean to suggest that he's like a garbage person, but I like their dynamic on the date where she is kind of where he's not really listening to her. He's not really like doing the things that she wants to do. When she says, like, can we just go to a movie? He blows her off. She still, you know, gets naked with him, which I don't understand that choice. But it's another one of those instances of like things aren't exactly as they seem.
Yeah, and I think that like that's the fun of the Funhouse that puts the fun in Funhouse
Yeah.
is that it is a movie that very much sort of messes with like your perceptions
Yes.
a lot, like you mentioned the opening, you know, kind of walking around the carnival, you know, but there is like a weirdness too, like I mean even like the scene with Madame Zina when they're all like stoned out of their mind and giggling and then she just like, you know, fuck all y'all
Breaks
and
character,
basically.
right.
Yeah, like it just shows you that there's like these facades, much like the funhouse and the carnival itself.
Or the William Finley scene where he stabs the girl and you think like, oh no, something's gone wrong. He's accidentally murdered this girl. And then it's revealed, no, it's just part of a trick. And it's his daughter, yet another familial relationship in the movie.
Yeah, also too, I think my one quibble with the funhouse, it needed more William Finley.
I don't disagree. I love that he was just part of the stock company of two of my favorite directors because he shows up in all these Tobe Hooper movies and all these Brian De Palma movies. And so I love that they both were all in on William Finley.
Yeah. I was like, I need more Marco. Like, it's funny. So, like, a few years ago, like, we actually were trying to make the title card treatments where it said, like, directed by Toby Hooper with the animatronic Fat Lady. We were actually trying to make a t-shirt for you. It was really hard for Pat, for Brian to like duplicate, so we had to like give it up a little bit. But now I'm like, I think what we really need is a Marco the Magnificent t-shirt.
Did Abe Snake ghost direct any scenes in the Funhouse? Could Abe Snake be the fourth carnival barker?
He probably was working at the strip show. If we're being honest,
What carnival
has a strip show,
has a
right?
strip tent?
Well, the funny thing is, like, what I love about it is apparently that might have been a thing because so one of my favorite things I used to get to do when I was doing like the whole journalism thing is like every year, because you know I'm a weirdo who loves electronic music. So we have this big event here in LA called Escape, and it's like a big music festival, but it's also a Halloween festival as well. And they actually do like old timey carnival shit there too.
Okay.
And they actually have like a tent where like weird magicians perform and you know crazy like freak show type of things. They also have girls dancing with like little tassels on their boobs. So apparently that was like a thing, I guess, back in the day. Like I think that was a thing to
That's
do sort of
super
like a
weird.
little you know a sexy girl review. I didn't grow up in that kind of carnival. Maybe
No.
my career trajectory might have been a little differently. I don't know, different. I don't know.
I do not remember that from the carnival in Elk Grove by the high school.
I do remember that carnival as well.
Yeah, no naked girls at the Elk Grove Carnival.
Unless you were having a really good night.
Well, sure. My nights were never that good at that point in my life, so darn.
Sucks to be you, Patrick.
Right? I
My,
know.
mine were.
Good for you.
Yeah. Ah, high school.
Another thing that I love about this movie that is kind of, I don't want to say off-putting because off-putting is the wrong word, but the John Beale score is wild because it's so dissonant and feels like the music that would be in your head if you were going crazy. And it starts from the very beginning. I mean, the credits open and it's like ba-dum, ba-dum, and then it starts in on this weird dissonant like carnival music, and it just works so well throughout the whole movie. I know Waxworks, I think, recently released like an expanded score on vinyl,
I was going to ask if
and
you got it.
I have it. I haven't listened to it yet, but I did get it
Okay.
because while I try not to buy things anymore ever, when it's Toby Hooper themed, it's hard to pass up, especially when there's a risk of it selling out.
Gotcha. Yeah, I it's one now that I kind of wish I had.
Yeah.
Because I really like listening to it again. I really wish like it's like, oh, this is good. Like, 'cause I have the Salem's Lot score, which I love. Oh, God, I love. But I will say, like, rewatching it, you know, for this show, like, I really love that score. I was like, oh man, I kind of feel like John Beale is like one of those guys, like, you know, there's so many composers we sort of always laud, and they should because like they're amazing. But like I feel like John Beale should get some more love. Also, I read when I was prepping for this if he worked with Deadmau5, so there you go.
Say that one more time.
I said I also when I was prepping for this, I was reading up on John Beale and I realized that he has worked with Deadmau5,
Oh, really?
who is one of our favorite performers in the EDM
Right.
world. So there you go.
Aren't you going to a Deadmau5 show?
I so it's funny. So the Deadmau5 show is actually the night of the signing.
Yes,
They're
it
doing his
is.
a 20-year retrospective on his career at the Hollywood Bowl, and we were like, "Oh my God, we have to be there." We got like cheap seats just because we did. Deadmau5 did like a series of shows in 2019 where it was like five shows in a row at the Palladium, and we went to three of those shows, and we were literally right against the stage for all of those. We're like, "We're never going to get that experience again."
Sure.
But not part of me was kind of thinking like, "Oh, maybe we shouldn't because we're at the signing. You're going to be in town and everything." And also because EDC, they just announced the lineup and he's like performing in three different iterations during EDC. So I was like, do we meet? Like, it, so yeah, it's, we're, I'm torn, but I think I'm gonna go.
Yeah, you should.
Yeah, no, we've got tickets, we'll go. But
Good.
like, yeah. So, but anyway, I just, it was like really interesting because like sometimes these guys, like, you know, they're a little older, you know, who knows what they're doing. But I was like, oh, look at that. Like, he's, you know, and I guess he worked with like Olivia Newton-John back in the day too, which is kind of cool.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, but I guess he also was like a really big trailer music guy,
Okay, I could see that.
which I thought was, yeah, which I thought was interesting. I guess he did the music for the Titanic trailer, which I thought was really cool. So I love stuff like that. Like, I
Yeah.
just feel like,
Go John Beal.
yeah. So he, I feel like he's one of those guys who's really been such an integral part of the sonic landscape of cinema. That sounds hoity-toity enough. Who just isn't appreciated. And I will say, like, I really totally fell in love with the score because it's so good. It really is super effective. Because it really lends itself well to the atmosphere that Toby is building throughout the film. And definitely kind of like comes at you sometimes like completely out of left field. And it really works. It's great.
Yeah. I love it. Again, I'm a sucker for basically every aspect of this movie. So if people are like, "Oh, I don't like this performance," or "I don't like the photography," or "I don't like the score," I'm just like, I can't see it because I love everything. So I went on the Waxwork Records website to see if the Funhouse vinyl had sold out. It has not. But I'm reminded of something, and I want to get your take on this. It's not related to the Funhouse, but it is tangentially related to Toby Hooper because it owes everything to Toby Hooper. What are your feelings on the upcoming release of the words and music of House of a Thousand Corpses? Are you familiar with this?
I've heard about it. I haven't read too much about it, but I'm intrigued by it. And I'm so glad you brought up House of Thousand Corpses because it's one of those, like, especially like discovering this movie, like really discovering it post House of Thousand Corpses, where it's like everybody's like, oh, you know, House is basically Rob Zombie doing Texas Chainsaw 1 and 2. And I'm like, oh, there is definitely a lot of Funhouse in there as well,
Yeah.
especially through the character of Captain Spaulding.
Yeah.
Where I'm just like, oh yeah, okay, I get it. Like basically, House of the Corpses is like Rob Zombie's love letter to Toby Hooper's career, in like so many different ways, which could be like our own, that could be our book. It'd be fascinating to write, because I think you could draw a lot of through lines from that film to a lot of Toby's like basically early career,
Yeah.
even to a degree, some aspects of like Eaten Alive, I think.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, so I don't know much about it, but I do know that there's also a game that I think Trick or Treat Studios is kickstarting right now
Oh, wow.
for House of Corpses, which I absolutely want, but like I'm in a hold on spending right now
Yeah.
because we are actually going to go on vacation, so I'm just trying to be really good about things. But I'm like, between new Nightmare t-shirts getting released and House of
Right.
Thousand Corpses here and there, I'm just like, oh my God, please stop giving me things that I need to own. Because I want all of it.
Yeah, they really have our number, don't
Oh, they do, especially mine. Oh.
they?
So,
So this House of a Thousand Corpses release is the movie on vinyl. It's
which
all the audio of the movie on vinyl.
I'm into that, and I'll tell you why. Because so I'm, you know me, I fall asleep to movies.
Right.
And so I don't actually need to sort of watch a movie to enjoy a movie, which sounds really weird. But what I used to do when I was in high school, when I would travel, I actually had cassette tapes of movies on cassette. So I always traveled with this sounds so stupid because I also traveled with the soundtracks for these movies. But three of the movies that I would travel with listening to the audio was Rocky Horror Picture Show,
Okay.
Wayne's World,
Okay.
and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Oh,
But I
very
also had the
nice.
soundtracks too.
Sure.
But I would just honestly just listen to movies.
I used to do that
So I,
too.
yeah, so I kind of like it in a way.
Yeah.
I think it's an intriguing concept. It'd be really fun to see if like this catches on more, because it's almost like audiobooks for movies in a
Right.
lot of ways.
Right.
And film is very much a visual medium, like, you know, Would I only ever listen to Wayne's World for the rest of my life? No, I want to watch it too. Because there's, the visual gags and things like that. But like, there is something fun about just listening to a movie. And I think that makes a really good case for like how crucial sort of the sound elements of a movie really are. Where, like, I think there was like a joke at the Oscars about like, my parents didn't understand what you did when you created sound, but like, it's just as vital, if not more. Because I'll tell you, like, if I'm watching an indie horror movie and like everything about the movie works, but I can't really, the sound sucks, it'll take me out of it immediately.
Sure.
So I will tell any like, up and coming filmmaker, like, look, you can pull back on other things that you need to, but never sacrifice your sound
Yeah.
because it's so crucial. And if people can't connect on that level, it's going to be really hard. So, but yeah, I think that's kind of cool. Like, I don't know, again, it might just be the old lady in me. And it was always tough when a movie was like over 90 minutes because you'd have to like really be on there to like, because like, your cassette tape would be 90 minutes. So it's like, I'm not putting Titanic on cassette tape, basically, is what I'm saying. Or The Godfather,
I used to record movies, episodes of The Simpsons. I would record the audio and wrestling matches.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I used to fall asleep to wrestling a lot too. Royal Rumble 99 was like a favorite of mine for a while.
Okay. I used to listen to the, I would go on walks with my Walkman and listen to the WrestleMania 5 Piper's Pit.
Nice. That's a good one. Is that the one with Martin Downey Jr.?
Yeah, and Brother
Yeah.
Love. Yeah, where he
Oh, yeah.
fire he pulls out the fire extinguisher.
Did you go around to people and say, "I love
Of
you"?
course I did.
First, you did paint your face red.
Of course I did.
Nice, excellent. I could see it.
Oh God, I miss Roddy Piper.
I do too.
Yeah.
One of my biggest regrets ever was not talking to him because he was at Flashback Weekend
Was he?
once when I was still just going as a fan.
Okay.
And I chickened out, and I'm still mad at myself to this very day, because
Yeah.
that might have been like 16, 17 years ago now at this point,
Sure.
because it was like mid 2000s, and I'm so mad that I didn't go and talk to him that day.
Yeah.
But I got so scared. I mean, dude, I literally the times that I met Robert Englund, like before, like I started doing all this, I literally went up for signatures and like couldn't say a word. And like now I know him, and it's like it's just so weird. I'm like, I said that to him once. When I was interviewing him for something, because I got to know him because of Rob Hall and stuff when I was working there,
Yeah.
and I was like, Robert, I was like, you won't even believe this, and I'm like, but like, I legitimately couldn't talk to you. Like, I went through like three different lines at 1 year at Flashback to meet him and have him sign things, and I didn't say shit the entire time. I couldn't talk to him. I'm like, it's Robert Englund. So yeah, I probably would have done the same thing with Roddy because God, I loved him so much.
You know, you should have said to Robert Englund, you should have gotten in line, waited 2 hours, gotten up to him, and then just said, "I love you."
It painted my face red. Yeah, I think that would have been the right way to handle that. You're right. Time machine, let's
Yeah,
do this.
you know, listen, I'm sorry to bust out these good ideas now when it's too late, but it's never
Yeah.
too late because you can always go, he's still with us. You can go see him.
I'm gonna do Brother Love for all of our shows from now on. So, in fact, that's how I'm gonna go to our signing, I think. I think I'm gonna dress up like Brother
Oh my
Love.
gosh, that would be the best. I think more people would come if they knew you were going to be dressed as Brother Love.
We both should, is what we should do.
Oh
I like it.
my gosh. What else about the fun house do you want to talk about?
I wanted to ask you, because I know this is like your favorite movie from Tobe Hooper. Like, I think there's the obvious answer, and I'm guessing this is what it's going to be, but I'm just curious.
Yeah.
So if you could own like one prop from the Funhouse, because there's a lot of cool shit in this movie,
Oh
what would it
boy.
be?
Oh
And
my.
is it the animatronic fat lady? Because I want her.
It's not the animatronic fat lady because where would I put it? It's simply too large.
Your children don't need their own bedrooms. Like, you've got a basement. They can live down there.
I think I would go baby in the jar.
Okay.
Yeah.
Baby cow man.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because I just the shot of them standing around it, looking at it is like imprinted on my brain, because it's one of the more famous images from the movie.
Yeah.
I mean, so's the animatronic fat lady. Like, of course, if you Google the Funhouse, that's what's going to come up. Is that what animatronic lady? Is that what you're going with?
I would, because
Yeah.
she's amazing. Like
Yeah.
it's that imagery is like so great.
Yeah. I remember the first time I did the Pure Cinema podcast, I was asked to program a 6-movie horror marathon, and I wanted an all-nighter like they do at the New Beverly in October. And so I ended deliberately with the Funhouse because I was like, there's something so cool about watching Amy stagger out into the daylight with just like garbage blowing around everywhere, and she just barely knows where she is. She's so lucky to be alive. Oh, we got to talk about that in a second too. And then you stumble out of the theater and it's daylight and there's garbage blowing around and you're feeling lucky to be alive. Like, it perfectly captures what it feels like to survive a horror movie all-nighter. I think the Funhouse should play last at every marathon.
Yeah, it has like this is a movie now I really wish I could see on a big screen. And I don't really know when I'm gonna get the opportunity to do it, but I'll tell you the next time. Like I like Vidiots, if you're listening, please, because first of all, I love your theater the most in terms of the repertory screenings. It's just easy to get to. Love the vibe, love the setup, it's all great. Please do the Fun House because I want to go and see this movie on a big screen.
Yeah, for sure.
Because I think it would rule. Yeah, I could totally see that. I definitely If I was like doing like 80s horror marathon like this, yeah, this is a good capper, I think.
One of the things that I think is interesting about the movie is the role of Amy as the final girl, because I think the first time I ever wrote about this movie, I sort of wrote about this phenomenon. She's not Nancy Thompson. She doesn't survive by being smart and brave
No.
and resourceful. She survives because, like, Gunther accidentally gets caught in the gears. Like, she survives through sheer luck. She's not even as canny as Liz, who at least tries to, like, seduce Gunther in order to survive. Amy just survives because she survives. And I think that's so interesting, and Tobe Hooper kind of repeats that idea more than once. But I mean, you could almost say the same thing about Marilyn Burns in the original Texas Chainsaw, but she at least jumps out the window. Like, she does something to save her own life, whereas Amy just kind of stands there and screams, and Gunther accidentally gets caught in the gears and dies.
Yeah, it's interesting because like I think these days because we have so much context, we have so much time to reflect on these things now where like we sort of champion the concept of final girl as having to have these certain qualities to them.
Right.
Where really if you look at Laurie Strode in the original Halloween,
Yeah, it's
she
not that
doesn't
different.
no, like it's she fights back, but it's not like it's super effective, nor is it super assertive. It's more of just like a, oh shit, I'm gonna grab a sewing, like a, you know, not a sewing needle. The hell is she doing?
Isn't it a coat hanger?
No, she has like a needle in her
Oh,
bag for like doing yarn work or whatever. I don't know why. I can't think of the right word for that.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
My brain is broken. You know what I mean? Like that's
It's
her
a
first thing.
needle,
And then,
whatever. It's a needle.
yeah. So it's not like she's just sort of doing it out of pure reflex, I think, for a lot of it. Where that's what I kind of like about Amy in this movie is like a lot of her reactions are very like it's a reflex.
Right.
It's not because she has a grand plan. It's not because she's like prepared for this moment. It's more like, okay, I'm legitimately by myself at a certain point. How in the hell am I going to get through this night? And it's like, oh, now he's coming for me. Okay, like, you know, I see gears. Let's figure, you know, let's just do what we can do to try to make it out. And there's nothing in the way that Elizabeth Berridge plays the character where you actually think she's gonna make it out. Like she doesn't like have that look on her face where she's like, I'm surviving this.
Right.
And I think for me, that also sort of ties in to Marilyn Burns at the end of Texas Chainsaw, where it's like, there's not like there's a desperation there in the
Yeah.
way, in like the eyes
Yeah.
that I think we see also in how Elizabeth plays Amy in this, where it's just kind of like, oh my God, this crazy thing is happening to me. Maybe I don't make it out, but I'm gonna try.
And in the grand tradition of Tobe Hooper characters, she's sort of driven to madness by the end of the movie, because I remember it playing at that 3 a.m. music box screening, and there was a whole row of like drunk guys next to me who were trying to sleep, and they were getting very annoyed between the strobe lights, the John Beale score, Gunther's shrieking, and Amy screaming. They were like, "Stop it!" Like, they hated the sound design because of how fucking insane it is at the end of this movie. It's just noise and shrieks, and Amy is sort of at the edge of madness by the end of this movie, much like many Tobe Hooper protagonists.
Yeah, and I also think too, what I love about that scene as well is that we see sort of a similar set piece get set up in Poltergeist, where like these parents have to be like literally on the brink of desperation
Yeah.
to like go into the other, like this other realm to
Yeah.
go get their daughter. And it plays out very similarly, which is interesting to me.
Are
Where
you
you
excited that we're talking about Poltergeist next?
Oh, you have no idea. I'm so excited. Oh, but no, this was like for me, I was really excited for Funhouse because I'm like, oh, Patrick's gonna get to geek out. Like, but also too for me, like, I think it's been like it had been about 4 years since I last saw it. So it was a good because I think I watched it like during COVID time.
Okay.
Like I kind of remember watching it that October.
Okay. It's
So it had been a while actually since
been
I'd
a
sat down
while.
and watched it. And was that, is that, that's not,
It's stained.
is that Creed? Oh, Stained. Oh, no. Okay.
Stained
Oh,
with
now
no
you're,
E.
I was gonna say, now you reminded me that Stained exists.
You're welcome.
There are no Hoobastank, though. Such great band names in the 2000s, weren't there?
It's they sound like part of the same sentence, like, "Oh man, your hooba stank stained my
Stained.
jeans."
And I am disturbed. I totally, oh yeah, so like I watched it then, and it like this reminded me, I was like, frick, like I need to watch this movie more, because it really, it's super duper fun, so I think it's one that I'm gonna kind of like try to incorporate more into my Octobers at the very least,
Nice.
because this really revitalized my appreciation for the Funhouse, so
I
thank
love
you for
that.
that.
Yo, thank you for talking about this movie with me, because I was very excited to get to this one. I'm kind of excited about all of them from here on out. Not that I was like not excited about Eggshells, but that one was a little bit like, I don't know that one as well, and I don't know what I'm going to say about it. But like, I feel like every time we get to one now, even something like Night Terrors, which isn't great, I'm like, oh, I get to revisit Night Terrors, and we get to find shit to say about Night Terrors. Like, I'm excited about that. You know, the 80s run is obviously my favorite, because we have Poltergeist, and then we get to do the Canon trilogy. So like, it's gonna be pretty sweet the next couple of months on Hanging with Tobe
Yeah,
Hooper.
for sure.
Everyone make sure that you order In Search of Darkness at aminkpublishing.com. Come out to the signing on April 27th, and we will be back next month to talk about Poltergeist. Thanks again, Heather.
Thank you, Patrick.